Good afternoon. I hope you were all able to join us this morning for the first panel of our symposium. If not, we will be posting a video of the panel on our website soon, so keep watching this space. We're very pleased this afternoon to have a panel focused on the spectacle of destruction, which I think is one of the more intriguing themes of the exhibition, to discuss its meanings and implications and our fascination with the subject. Today we are very honored to have with us as our moderator, Robert Rosen, who is an educator, critic, preservationist, and dean emeritus of the UCLA School of Theater, Film, and Television. He has published widely in the field of media preservation and is the founding director of the UCLA Film and Television Archive. In fact, as far as I can tell, he's pretty much the founding director or board member of any organization that has to do with preservation of film, as you'll see. He's the founding director of the National Center for Film and Video Preservation at the American Film Institute. He's the founding board member of the National Film Preservation Board of the Library of Congress. With Martin Scorsese, he was the organizer of the Film Foundation, for which he serves as the founding chair of its Archivist Council. There are more, but that was just a few highlights. Among his many awards, he has received the John Houston Award for Artist Rights from the Directors Guild of America. And also for 10 years, he was the film critic for KCRW, National Public Radio. So we're very pleased to have him here today as our moderator. Next to him, we have, everybody switched around, Kevin Rosario, who is an associate professor of American Studies at Smith College. He has a PhD in American History from Yale University. And although trained as an historian, he has delved into many fields, including literary criticism, media studies, art history, philosophy, economics, corporate studies, environmental history, gender studies, politics, and cultural theory. So he's quite the Renaissance scholar over there. He's the author of The Culture of Calamity, Disaster and the Making of Modern America, which won the 2008 Lois P. Rudnick Best Book Prize. He's currently writing a book on the underground as a site of artistic innovation and political dissent in the United States from the 19th century to our global digital capitalist age. So we're very pleased to have him as well. To his left, we have artist Ori Gerst, who we're very pleased to have in our exhibition with a work that is actually in the Hirschhorn collection. He's born in Tel Aviv, but is currently living and working in London. He has an MA in photography from the Royal College of Art in London, and he's currently a professor at the University of Creative Arts in Kent. He has many solo exhibitions. They include exhibitions recently at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, the Imperial War Museum in London. He was one of the earlier black box series for the Hirschhorn, which we're very pleased to have him back in 2008, and also at the Tate Britain in London. Group exhibitions include at the National Gallery in London, the Guggenheim, the J. Paul Getty Museum in Los Angeles, and the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. His works are included in many collections globally, including the Hirschhorn's and the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, the Guggenheim, and the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. So we're very pleased to have him join us today. And finally, on the far left, we have Joe Masco, who is a professor of anthropology at the University of Chicago, where he writes and teaches courses on science and technology, U.S. national security culture, political ecology, mass media, and critical theory. He's the author of The Nuclear Borderlands, The Manhattan Project in Post-Cold War New Mexico, which won the 2008 Rachel Carson Prize from the Society for Social Studies of Science. He also has a forthcoming book called The Theater of Operations, National Security Effect from the Cold War to the War on Terror. And he's currently posted at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, where he's researching a book on environmental crises. We're very pleased to have them all with us today to talk about this complex subject from various perspectives. So thank you for being here. I'll turn it over to Robert Rosen.
Well, first of all, I am delighted to be here at this, I think, extraordinarily important, provocative, and distressingly relevant exhibition. I wasn't sure we would get here, given the events in Washington recently, but seeing the display of auto self-destructive politics played through as performance art, I felt that this was a both a ironic and even poignant preview of today's program. I have two roles here. One is as a moderator, and I thank the organizers for having such smart and talented people, which will make it very easy for me. So I want to pose a few questions out there on your behalf. And the other is, to bring in a film dimension as well. Actually, a movie dimension as well, because film is already very much part of the exhibition. The questions I want to pose on your behalf, because just about anybody coming to something as provocative and broad as an exhibition, a multifaceted exhibition dealing with destruction and images of destruction and the social dimensions of destruction, is that there are a number of questions that undoubtedly come to mind. So on your behalf, let me lay out five of them, and then I'll go to the people who actually know answers, and we'll talk about it. The one is, what's selected to be destroyed? Out of all of those things in the world, why is it that we come back again and again to things like cars? Jean-Luc Godard suggested maybe that's because of the irony of killing people with your possessions. And that this makes a certain kind of statement, but there are many others made by many other people and artists and what have you over time. Or why is New York, long before 9/11, so often the object of destruction? Are there reasons for that that we might talk about? So one question is, what's selected out for destruction and why? We also, complementing that, is the question is, by what agency? Meteors, asteroids, monsters, 50-foot women, the follies of science, what have you, what are some of the agencies for that destruction? Another issue is, what in the society gives rise to these images? We had a really great presentation that suggested after World War II, there was World War II and the Holocaust and nuclear bomb that seemed to put destruction on the agenda. But what about all those disaster movies in the 1970s? Astounding number of them. Could that have something to do with the disasters of the 1970s? And what about the fact that right now there is this resurgence of destruction, astounding array of destruction that's taking place, often leading to apocalyptic visions of the end of all the world? What is it about the contemporary world that puts apocalypse and that kind of massive destruction on the table? So the second question is about the society. A third question clearly has to do with the aesthetic, the look, the sound of destruction, and whether or not each art form, and there are so many represented in this exhibition, has its own aesthetic, or there's certain kinds of aesthetic elements that seem to recur and transcend and come to all of them. Another issue, one of the most difficult and perverse, are the pleasures associated. The pleasures for the artist, the pleasures for the spectator. I ask, here, if you can, this is entirely by chance. When yesterday in the living room, at the other end was a 7-year-old drawing, and we said, what is it, David, what are you drawing? And he said, the destruction of New York. That is a large alien, and it's atomic destruction. You can tell David he's been shown at the Hirshhorn Nest. But the question of the pleasure that kids get in knocking things over, but the pleasure we get And I hope we're going to talk a little bit about the piano event yesterday. And the responses to that and the complexity of the responses to that, which is an odd mix of being very upset and very pleased. And how that comes together. So, one final question. One of the assumptions, and a number of the speakers this morning alluded to that, is that the art of depicting and conveying destruction has a rebellious dimension to it, has a socially critical dimension. Does it? Are there possibilities that it also has a deadening dimension? Something that in essence takes the edge off sensibilities, or both, and under what circumstances? So those are the questions I like to put out there. The one prerogative I want to do as a movie guy up front is to take a look at a clip. And then we'll talk about the clip a little bit and then enter into the discussion that the people on this stage will lead. And the clip is Michelangelo Antonioni. This is a Zabriskie Point. How many people have seen it? A few. Oh, more than I expected. The movie made in 1970. Antonioni is someone for whom an action sequence might be a intense stare, possibly with a blink, who nonetheless chose to end Zabriskie Point with a rather astounding display of destruction. Keep in mind, this is before the digital. This is not digital effect. This is destruction. So let's take a look at the clip. We'll talk about the clip just a few minutes and then open it up. We don't have to move, do we? Or do we? Okay, great. We'll be in the midst of the destruction. Okay. Pretty cool. Why don't we talk a little bit, just to sort of warm up a little bit about the clip, if you have anything you'd like to say about it, because a lot of the complex issues dealing with the spectacle of the destruction comes up in here. And anyone want to get going?
Sure. To me, this is an interesting reply to the last scenes from Dr. Strangelove, where we have a series of blasts going off and the tune, "We'll Meet Again." And it raises this question for me about the pull towards the destruction, the aesthetics of destruction, and also this issue of if you can slow it down, it becomes something really different, something you can get lost inside and enjoy as a different kind of spectacle than if it is played out in real time. The other component of this for me is that it's a desert scene involving repeating explosions that ends with a kind of supernova sun, which is also, given the work that I do on nuclear history, also something that could be playing on the destructiveness of the American desert and the idea that in its perfect form it has no human beings in it. And that there's also a Nevada test site not far from where this was filmed, but of course for more than 40 odd years was the place in which gigantic detonations took off that were also extraordinary photographic spectacles that we could talk about as well. The problem of actually photographing and visualizing nuclear tests was one of the major challenges to the U.S. nuclear program. And so there was in addition to building the bomb, there was a huge kind of photographic experimental regime around it that produced perhaps some of the techniques actually that we're seeing in this clip about ultra slow motion and the pleasures of getting inside a form of violence to such a degree that it becomes an aesthetic universe of its own that one can get lost in. Yeah. And I think one of the cinematic effects of this is also plays out in the repetition and the idea that you need to keep seeing it over and over again, that there's something incredibly seductive in the force of that, that also gets in the way of the actual nature of the violence that you're seeing. So I could say more, but perhaps...
Yeah, I was struck by your response on cool when we see this, and I suspect that's the way that many of us feel looking at this scene, that it's aesthetically striking, the music amplifies the aesthetic power of this. Do I have to wear my double-breasted? Is that better? Okay. So I was struck by Bob's response to this as being cool in some ways, and that there's almost a preconditioned response at this moment in history to a scene like this. And I was thinking a lot of it in terms of genre and about movies and the ways that it's not necessarily that there's a natural response to an image like this that we respond to as being cool, but that we've been conditioned or imprinted or educated by movies themselves over the last 100 years. To respond to images like this as sources of entertainment. And where do we see these images? We go into a movie house. How are we supposed to respond to an image like this? Well, we know that if we're in a movie house that we're supposed to feel some kind of pleasure. And it seems to me that... one example of this. There was a movie came out about, 10 years ago called Left Behind. Did anybody see that movie? It was part of the sort of Christian evangelical movie. It was on the circuit. Kurt Cameron, I think, was involved in it. And the movie was a version of the very popular 60 million sold copies of Left Behind, which is all about the evangelical rapture. And it's supposedly these books and this movie is about doctrine. The audiences were supposed to go to books and movies like that in order to learn something about the Bible or to be instructed in religion. In some ways, and I was actually one of the few people who watched the making of that movie. And the thing that struck me about the making of that movie is that over and over again, they spent all of the time thinking about the explosions. And whenever somebody tried to have a conversation about doctrine or meaning or anything like that, nobody cared. But what really mattered, they put something like 90% of their budget into the explosions. And the quote that I remember from that is, "It's not a movie until it's got an explosion in it." And so somehow, even people who supposedly this is an evangelical group that defines itself in some ways against Hollywood mainstream culture. Even they have been produced, I think, by 100 years of cultural imprinting to think about movies as spaces where we respond to images of destruction as sources of... we've been taught that it should be a source of pleasure in some ways. And of course, it's enhanced by the slow motion, by the music, Pink Floyd, you throw that in there, and sort of gives everybody a good vibe. So I think that's part of what's going on here, too.
And there is the extraordinary spectacle that movies are delivering, and those images are coming way out of the ordinary. So all of a sudden, it's not a voyeuristic act, but we are invited into space that is unavailable to us. Mm-hmm. I think that this association to the nuclear explosion is very interesting, in particular in the context of the desert. And one of the things that I keep thinking about the nuclear explosion as obviously the ultimate disaster, the apocalypse, but also the ultimate moment of creation, about the Big Bang. Yeah. And I think that it's important when we're talking about destruction, because we can talk about a certain satisfaction that is coming with the act of maybe the cathartic act of destroying something, but there is something fundamental that within the act of destruction there is also the moment of creation, and they intertwine with each other. And I think that this is one of the the most beautiful dialectics that are part of our existence on this planet. And for me, the greatest satisfaction that comes with destruction is a certain clarity that is emerging out of it. George Batari is talking about this in his book, The Accursed Share. He constantly talks about production that leads to excess, and then there must be consumption.
Yeah.
And how those two forces are really complementary of each other. And every one of the two worlds world war emerges as a result of excess with no consumption. And it's reached a point... Oh. And it's probably my son. Wait. My son probably phoning to tell me about the football, the soccer result.
Mine comes on in a few minutes. You'll see.
And really, when there is no consumption,
right,
there is an accumulation of energy. As Bataille kind of look at it, accumulation of energy that is ending up in a disastrous apocalyptic explosion.
Yeah.
Hence, First World War, which I think it's an interesting moment to talk about, because we are just coming now to 100 years since 1914, which is.
Clearly, this has evoked thoughts. I think there are probably many other thoughts out here. A few more that I'd want to add in. One of them that have to do with, in part, the function of destructive spectacle. The one is, this is a subjective from the point of view of the girl. She clearly is pissed with the world. She is imagining these explosions taking place. And one of the pleasures, and to be explored in some way, of destructive spectacle is what I call aggression with impunity, either on the part of the artist or on the part of the spectator. There's a pleasure that's being taken in that destruction, and because it is a spectacle, it's only a movie. And that combination of being able to empathetically participate in the massive destruction and go home and have dinner afterward. That combination of aggression with impunity is one of the things. A second thing is the social commentary. Clearly, there is a notion here of consumerism as being both something that you want to blow up, you know, massive consumerism is something the opposition. Or it may itself be the cause of violence. But the notion of the TV going up and the other objects of the house floating out there, it makes a social statement. This is one that is a rebellious and critical social statement. The third part, which you people have done better than I could, is the fact that it's also beautiful. The notion that this destruction that we're seeing is giving you aesthetic pleasure. This, you know, the combination of movement and color and sound converging with one another actually is an extraordinarily pleasurable experience. All the more troubling because it's also this destruction that's going on. And the fourth thing, and I'm sure this passed through your mind, given that this movie was made before the digital, and we'll talk a little bit later, maybe, about what the digital has done to images of destruction, and that is, dare I say, auto-destruction. We're aware of the fact that that is not a digital image, that's a house. Well, actually, it isn't quite. They shot the movie in a house and then built a model of the house, a full-size model of the house separately, and blew up the model. They weren't going to blow up the site. And you're aware of the fact that, and movies do this, spend a lot of money destroying themselves. And you take a certain pleasure in that. Now, that again becomes significantly vitiated once you get into the digital. But once you know that that's a real thing. So all of these elements we've talked about are operating. Which is the dominant one? Well, if you ask Antonioni, and I did, you get ambiguous answers. It's a little of this, it's a little of that. It's, you know, a little pasta, a little this, a little, you know, whatever. And that's his way of thinking. But all of them are operative, and they begin to open a window onto the multiple dimensions of the images and spectacle of destruction. I hope this was worth starting it this way, and why don't we get back into some of the other issues we talked about. Yeah.
Just one quick thing. So the idea of a domestic space being blown up in a long extended sequence in which the commodities in the house are part of the destruction and the point of the aestheticization of the violence is something that the National Security State actually pioneered. And if you go online and look up two films, one would be called Operation Q from 1955, and another would be called The House in the Middle, you'd have a version of the end of this movie, except made by the nuclear state and directed at the American public to communicate what nuclear war would look like, to mobilize households for hygiene purposes, to take care of their houses so fires wouldn't erupt. And there was a whole kind of effort to both create a normalized American middle-class, white, suburban everyday that was being blown up in perpetuity. And that was a source of nation building in the early Cold War. And it was part of a very large-scale effort that we call civil defense, which was an emotional management project to get people to think about the bomb in a particular way, to embrace certain images of violence as ways of building community and building nation. So the end of the nation became the way in which you established it. And that was through the rehearsal of certain images of the end, but also very large-scale civil defense exercises that basically invited everybody to play out in the middle of the day the end of the country. And so I can't see a film like this and not see Antonioni looking at America with a little bit of like, you know, what? And coming back a decade or two later and returning these images to the world and to the American public, but with a different political agenda around them. So.
Let me ask you something that segues out of this, and it's relevant in the contemporary setting, and that is each art form, whether it's photography or painting or performance art or what have you, is trying, and in this case the movies, is trying to create a sense of verisimilitude. It's true. This is real. Real, you know. In a contemporary setting, when in digital technologies cows can fly, you can put somebody's head on somebody else's body, and where the photographed image that for 100 and some odd years was an evidence of reality, we all know from our home computers you can do anything you want with it. Talk a little bit about, you know, within the various art forms, this quest to be convincing and real, and how that has been, if it has been, undermined in a digital age.
You can talk about my piece of the exhibition, which once again...
Well, talk about it, talk about it.
Involved an explosion. I think one thing that is crucial to me in the process of making work is the authenticity of the moment. And despite the fact that the flower arranged carefully in a film studio and we put all the pyrotechnics and we had to freeze the flowers with liquid nitrogen and everything is so carefully constructed, the actual moment that the camera is recording is an authentic moment that I could never anticipate the outcome, and the camera is becoming or is taking its most natural role as a recording device of an event. So it becomes then the film that I get is a documentation of something that happened, an authentic moment that happened that come as a surprise to the entire crew. I actually often worked on those films with people that are involved in commercial, and we tend to have some tension moment, because working on commercial, people like to know what the outcome will be in advance. There is no space for chance. And in the work that I produce, it's all about those unanticipated opportunities that may emerge and then to recognize them and start to exploit them. And again, when you work in the digital world, I'm talking post-production digital, you become very much in control. I kind of feel that often it can bring it can make those moments very contrived and lose some things that the chance, the accident. At the same token, the means of production for those films is digital. So I use digital camera, digital devices, and I work with a high-speed camera that are shooting directly into a hard drive. But the reason for that is because the work that I make is constantly in conversation with art history, and the outcome is very close to, in this instance, to the still life painting from 17th century. Although the work itself is anything but a still life, because I'm recording an event that's happening in an enormous speed, and it's all about movement rather than still life. But it's crucial for me that the means of production will be as removed as possible from painting. Sure. So if painting is a very visceral and physical process where every brushstroke is left on the canvas, it's important for me that the work that I make now will be as close as possible to pure abstraction, which is even analog film cannot produce, because still there is the celluloid and the silver on top of it. So on the one hand, the digital is kind of giving actually an as a means of production access to capture the world in ways that maybe were unavailable in before. But in terms of post-production, I'm very much aware that in my instance, take away from the role of the camera and the relationship that the camera had with some sort of the notion of an authentic truth.
Well, the question, one of the more recent Superman. Now, in the past, if Superman was involved in a battle with someone and a building was falling over, he would obviously, given all of the deaths and what have you that would come, would go and stop the building. But most recently, Superman just kind of ignored it. He was fighting a bad guy, but fundamentally, the total destruction and loss of life around him was one of total indifference, almost as if he knew this is a digital effect. And that everyone in the audience knows that's a digital effect. And one of the questions I guess I'm posing is, in terms of the spectacle of this, and you spoke very well to it, the spectacle of destruction, whether it's tougher now to do a spectacle of destruction given the fundamental skepticism and knowledge of people about what's really going on. That piano we knew is a real piano. That's one of the reasons it's so unhinging. We'll come back to it. But most, in a contemporary world, it might be tougher, much tougher and different to convey that sense of destruction than it might have been in a pre-digital age. And that's just...
But this doubt is true to anything. Whatever we see on the news, it's poised question to our entire existence in the world, not just destruction. How we define, what is the notion of reality? What is where the authentic moment is? Is there an objective?
Yeah.
But I think the one thing that seems to remain constant through this is this notion of the authentic, the violent or the destructive as the moment of authenticity. So that the verisimilitude seems to be secondary in some senses to the fact that we all want to get access to something authentic. And what is authentic? The authentic is when something is blowing up. That's when you're peering behind the superficial surface of life and you're getting behind it to what really matters. And it kind of reminded me, you were talking about Bataille, and Bataille was constantly going on about how you're in the presence of the things that matter when destruction is happening. Mm. That's what really matters. Love is kind of you know, it's just sentimental hoo-ha. Nobody really cares about love and stuff. But if you want to know something about how the world works, you get to the destructive core of it. And it strikes me about your work, for example, upstairs. Is it upstairs or downstairs? Where are we now? We're in the basement. Okay, upstairs. Is that it can be digitally manipulated, but in some senses we suspend our anxiety around that kind of lack of verisimilitude because we feel that we're getting close to something that's authentic. Mm-hmm. And the authentic is that we've learned something about the destructive process at the center of life. Because you could, and also presumably you could have filmed for about 20 minutes without a destructive moment in that image. That would be verisimilitude perhaps, but we don't care. That's not the authentic that we really care about. We want the authentic when something bang, sort of some kind of crisis, some kind of destruction is happening. And it works. And that's I don't know why it works. Yeah. And I can actually sit and watch 20 minutes of nothing better than most people, but I also find myself responding to your piece very viscerally. It does feel as if that something real is happening here.
Yeah, I would just say something quickly about like the Hollywood version of this, which is that for about 40 years, the kind of, you know, destruction of American cities on film for pleasure always was connected to a certain kind of moralizing gesture, either an effort to rebuild the nation, to think about the perils of Cold War confrontation. There was a kind of regeneration through violence logic that by considering violence, one was supposed to be altered by that experience, and there was an opportunity for some kind of collectivity to come out of this. With the new computer-generated graphics of the 90s and on, it seems to me that what's important now is the resolution. It's like, can you see destruction with a higher degree of clarity? And we don't actually have movies that are offering you to contemplate the end of the world as a serious thing to avoid. You actually, you know, you want to see it, and you want to see it in higher and higher degrees of detail because that's the promise of the technology. So the summer blockbuster is a space for a certain kind of spectacle where you can now suspend a great deal of the kind of political frame for what you're seeing and just enjoy it for, you know, the clarity of its picture, so to speak.
Come back to the piano. That was unsettling. One reason being it was uncontestably a real piano with real physical attributes and keys and strings, you know, and wood, and what have you. With an eye toward segueing into the question of, you know, the verisimilitude, and why don't we talk a little bit about your responses to that event last night. Was everyone there, or many people were there? This was a destruction by the man down here with an axe of a grand piano. I had a very strong response to that, and I was wondering what you guys.
Yeah. One thing that struck me about it watching last night was that it felt different from watching a guitar being destroyed. And as somebody who plays a guitar rather than a piano, there's a guitars seem more disposable in some ways, whereas a piano signifies classical culture, the continuities, the great arts, and so forth. And so I think that the choice of instrument is really important here. The choice of axe is probably less important, but there was a sense in which there was an object that stood in for culture and civilization, and that's
And what was your response when you watched this happening?
Frankly, for me, it was somewhat hyper-real, which is to say that I've seen videos of you destroying pianos, and then I was there watching you destroy a piano, surrounded by videos of you destroying a piano, and so I'm not sure that as a postmodern citizen that I had access to an unmediated response. I'd already lived through it in some ways, and so I think that might have.
Well, we're going to come back to the notion of repetition.
But I might have
and its impact on response to, yeah.
So less anxious than I might have felt if I'd seen it for the first time without.
I find it simultaneously disturbing and attractive, and I think that the sound that came out of the piano that animated it and gave it a kind of some sort of life of an organism that is struggling was it was a very powerful aspect. It was disturbing immediately. I couldn't throw association about what is the difference between destroying a piano and burning a book or burning books. And I also kind of this even further association, and this comes back to your discussion about the digital. If we see a decapitation of somebody in a film, and we still go to the film and we get some pleasure, if we see a real decapitation, then will we still get the pleasure? What is the point where we're looking at a moment that is grotesque and brutal, and we say, actually, I can't look at it. It's not, doesn't give me pleasure. Or if we see a real, what we conceive as a real explosion, we see it on the news, or we see it for real, of somebody's house, and we know that some people got killed there, will we still get satisfaction from it? Even if it's mediated through the media. With the piano, I mean, it was a physical experience, and I think that it kind of brought some of those thoughts to mind that we also raised, I think, early on in the conversation here. So I think that it comes back to, it's not just if the possibilities of the digital, it's also our awareness and understanding, or the knowledge that we perceive as viewers, that informing us our understanding of what we are looking at.
Yeah, that was beautifully put. The only thing I would add was what struck me, in addition to the violence of it and the sound, was the labor of it and just the physicality. And I thought, this piano is such a complicated piece of machinery, and it takes so much work to dismantle it in this way. And so it made me think about all the other things that we are dismantling through cumulative labor. I'm in a lot of conversations about things like climate change right now, where the destructive force of that is a total achievement of like human activity. No single individual is doing it, but collectively, planetary violences are being unleashed in a way. And that's a kind of labor, a kind of collective labor that we're only now starting to have the right language and grammar and means of thinking about. And so for me, the complexity of the piece, of the performance piece, was thinking about the temporalities of destruction and the amount of labor that goes into it. And it was extraordinarily powerful.
But I think also the artistry that goes into it struck me too. And having seen also images of John Cage using all sorts of different types of objects to produce music, and what struck me, two things struck me about the performance last night. One is the way that the wind became part of the, became an artist in some ways, that some of the strings were hanging up and catching the breezes and creating these incredible sound effects, and it enhanced our sense of what it felt like a very intensely constructive and creative experience for me in that context, as a happening rather than as a strict piece of musical performance.
I found a very, I went through a series of responses. The initial response is, what the hell are you doing? There's the work of craftsmen, of all kinds that put together this thing, and not only is it symbolic of culture, it is a manifestation of, of culture. And what the hell are you doing? And since my friend here is much more political than I am, what kind of bourgeois pleasures are you providing? Okay? And then, as it evolved, first of all, it was a great performance, and the piano performed well because when you hit it, it was almost like a live entity that was crying out when you hit those strings. There was almost a human, at least an animalistic interaction that was going on. And the moment of truth for me, and about the spectacle of destruction, was when I said, and I bet other people thought that too, why don't you finish the job? You did a lot of damage to that piano, but it was still on its three legs, why didn't you finish? And suddenly I became aware of how something that was reprehensible, when turned into spectacle, makes you now complicit in the activity. I wanted you to finish the job, you know, what have you. And the political power of spectacle, you know, to transform you from repulsion, then to mediate that into complicity. I was with you. Was very sobering. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. Hey, you guys, if you got something you want to talk about, just talk about it. I got my a lot of questions here. So, you know, but one that I know based on some writing had to do with this question of rebelliousness, consciousness, and whether it act. This was a moment where I was enhanced in consciousness, ultimately. You know, I was made aware of my complicity through spectacle. There is the argument that spectacle, particularly when repeated, people talk about the 9/11 buildings going down and seeing it again and again and again and again and again and again, actually is deadening of response. That the, you know, that the politics of the spectacle of the destruction is actually counterproductive ideologically rather than
a piece of it. You know, so there's something in modernity in the acceleration of technology in which one can consider that a kind of attack on the nervous system in and of itself. In the 19th century, when the railroads were being built, there were whole new illnesses created just by the encounter with the speed of transportation itself. And the idea that these new modes of travel were actually rewiring the human body in ways that required that you, as an individual, anesthetize yourself to withstand the acceleration, the technological change, and that one way to read the story of the 20th century is that that's the game played out over and over again in new medium, including in new visualization mediums. And so what one way to talk about that is that the anesthetization is part of a response to ever greater modes of stimulation, and that our bodies become overloaded and can't maintain kind of a correct attitude towards all of the different kinds of technologies and forces that are around us. I think, you know, 24-hour news is kind of based on a version of this, right, where one has to circulate endlessly kind of very similar stories with escalating notions of shock for an audience to stay tuned in. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you get bored, right? And so...
Yeah, well, we've got the piano man here. You've got something?
Post-traumatic syndrome, you know, the whole idea of someone sobering and being alert within their idea of being destroyed and destroying, and that process continuing long enough, I don't think that person becomes jaded, because we have that post-traumatic syndrome, we have a high rate of suicide that comes out of that, the impact of that.
Okay, I don't know if people have heard that back there, but why don't someone speak to that? Repeat it and
so,
speak to it.
The question of soldiers getting traumatized by experiences and then what but reliving them though.
So, the
yeah, well, I suppose there's several ways of linking these issues up, and as Joe was saying, one of the challenges of modernity, I guess, is to develop a sense of cool. And the historians of cool say that why are we so invested in being cool is because we kind of have to be, because we're bombarded with stimulus all the time, and that if you weren't able to manage all of this sort of hailing noises and sounds and images, that you would simply fragment and fall fall apart. So there's a defense mechanism for survival in this kind of a society. But then you have situations like war and battle lines and bombings and so forth, which break through those cool defenses. And it seems in some ways trauma is a sign of the breakdown of those kind of defensive stratagems in a way. What does that mean in terms of the way that we cope with destruction or with...
There are certain nightmares, there's a replay of things, finally it is
But there is a real difference between personal experiences and experiences that are mediated to us through television. When we see somebody else being killed or somebody else being divorced, we hear that through the news, we can look at it as entertainment or gossip. And obviously when we experience it ourselves, it's very different. And I think that one of the issues is how information is transpassed and what do we do with this information? How we generate a level of empathy that is also motivating us to enact and to make a change. And I think that one of the problems is that we are it's the quantity of information that are being just thrown at us that are creating this sort of emanation. And I often feel that they actually works of art, unlike what come to us through the media, is one of the roles of work of art is to be able to create those bridges, to allow the viewer to engage with some personal film. Because one of the differences, I think, with between a work of art and an item that is coming on the news, that the work of art provide the viewer not with a didactic experience, but with a much more democratic experience. The viewer is coming to the work. I feel with the moment I put a work on the wall, it's not mine anymore. And no matter what my intentions were, obviously they are somehow suggested in the piece, but they are left out of the equation, and the viewer come and project himself into the work. And hopefully there are enough hooks and triggers and stimulation there to allow the viewer to develop a very personal experience. And I think through those personal experiences we can come in them. What is transpassing to us can be much more intimate, and then those issues about the immune system are maybe being pushed sideways a bit.
You got kind of abstract, but I mean, how does the bullfighter deal with that?
How the bullfighter, sorry?
Right, you don't hear about bullfighters committing suicide. That impact, the danger of the bull and being warned, and then the idea of also killing the bull is part of your survival in that process,
I think that the relationship, the relationship that the matador has with the bull is quite complex, because there is, I think that there is, the bullfighter adores the bull. The bull is the animal that a bullfighter will looking up to, and there is somehow almost there is an alter ego to some extent, and there is a feminine masculine relationship, and it's an act of it's a sacrificial act, and also a painstaking act. When the bullfighting is killing the bull, is as if it's something that may be close to the Aztec that would kill, will sacrifice the prisoners that he caught in the world, as if something in him is being killed, and it's also an act of a cathartic act. I feel that I'm not sure that the bullfighting is a good analogy, because it's wrapped with so many cultural association and traditional meanings that the act itself, it's not a pure act of violence of two people that are just going to face each other in a war and trying just to rip each other head and are unprepared for it. When it comes to bullfighting, there is a lot of kind of cultural foundations.
Could we wait till later when we can bring down a microphone so we can hear you?
But maybe I could just add one thing on this that also is brings up the question of the repetition in images. So you asked the question about soldiers and post-traumatic stress, in which, you know, that circuit is the experience of some kind of violence that one can't get out of. After the violence has ended, it becomes internalized and is part of a repeating structure that reworks the psyche from the inside and, you know, can lead to suicide, as you were pointing out, but also can just structure a life through the repetition of some partial memory of an experience that may or may not be recoverable. But we have versions of this that operate in a really different way, just through the level of images. One was brought up in the fact that when the plane struck the towers on September 11th, there was a pretty widespread reaction that people had already seen that before, right? So how is it that something that was an unprecedented event could be experienced as something that was familiar and actually had a kind of hypnotic quality because people already had a relationship to it before the event happened? Partly that is something that maybe was produced out of the repeated attacks on New York in cinema for 40 some odd years, from the ways in which the nuclear state always imagined New York as its primary target. So if you've gone through any kind of military training or learned any of the kind of nuclear thinking developed along the long Cold War, you saw New York destroyed over and over again in official documents. But then there's a new version of this as well, which is those individuals that are flying the drones on the other side of the world. They're in various parts of the U.S., so they're connected now to a highly technologically mediated system for remote flying of machines, you know, that are very far away from the individual. They're now having post-traumatic stress. So the act of flying and the act of killing, even when hyper-mediated by the most extreme distances and the most extreme kinds of technologies right now, has the same effect of being literally on the battlefield and can produce a similar kind of lifetime struggle, I think, with the act of killing, with the act of violence itself. So it's so those are three different ways in which a kind of traumatic injury is being produced, either through the physical experience of it or through the highly mediated image registers.
The question, we will get some microphone down here in a few minutes and continue this dialogue. You ought to be up here. The issue of the extent to which art, particularly art that has spectacle of destruction, results in clicks of consciousness that, you know, that change attitude or maybe change behavior is a really good question. I mean, as you wander through this astounding exhibit out here, how often are you truly moved by what you see? You may be. How often are you deeply troubled by what you see? You know, many years ago, this was a totally different world, but during the Vietnam events, when there was a concern that people had now come to buy into napalming of children, we put out a press announcement that we were going to napalm a puppy on the steps of the library. We had no intention of doing it. It's amazing the people who showed up in the press. That breakthrough to identity, and to what extent are the images and the ubiquity of the images out there ultimately having an effect of getting you used to it, making it more, you know, accustomed to what's going on, you know, as opposed to provoking reflection. It's a tough issue. On the issue of,
I just wanted to talk, you started to talk about works of art, and I think that an important issue to raise is aesthetic values. When we're making plastic art that is it's primarily experienced through some sort of visual exchange, and the attention to details and beauty are fundamental to it, and it's something that I think about it often in my work, how there is a collision between a moment that is extremely violent and at the same time this desire to deliver a moment that is incredibly beautiful to a point that the violence can be is forgotten, and the viewer immerses himself or herself in beauty and almost forget or how beauty can create some sort of a screen that yep. That transform the viewer to a very different space, and the inconsolable tension that exists between what you're actually looking at, which can be a very grotesque and violent moment, to the genuine pleasure that you get, almost meditative pleasure, of looking at incredibly beautiful moment. Yesterday I was at the National Gallery, and this question and those issues are relevant to the Renaissance time, and you look sometimes at the most gory events, but the execution, the technique, the application of paint are just sublime. So you look at some of the, Titian or Bellini's painting, and it's very interesting to see the subject that is depicted, and the manner and the attention and the obsession in detail, and the beauty of execution, that as a viewer you come, when I stand in front of this painting, I come closer and closer, and this aura of the end of the artist is often removing me from the subject, and then so there are those parallel existence of those dichotomies or collisions.
What haven't we talked about that you would like to talk about?
What haven't we talked about? One thing that it was struck me when I was researching the long history of representations of destruction, especially in American culture, was that the enthusiasm for images of destruction went way back. And the exhibit here starts in 1950, for obvious reasons, given this post-nuclear and so forth. But if you go back to the 1600s and look at Puritan sermons and so forth, from the very beginning, American culture is bound up with images of disaster and destruction, and partly as a way just to get people into what were, I suppose, the 17th century version of movie houses, which was churches. How do you get people into the churches? Well, partly you do it by forcing them to go, but partly also by the topics that you talk about. And over and over again, it was destruction was the topic that you talk about, and it lavishly rendered. It's not just that do this and you'll go to hell, but that this is what hell looks like, and you will be punished in this way. Lovingly rendered versions of the punishments that people would get. And one of the things that struck me about reading about responses to that is that disaster became so embedded in American culture so early that the absence of disaster from people's lives was an occasion for some anxiety. So that there's the Archbishop of Usher back in the 17th century, or the 1700s, I think it was. One of the major anxieties that he had in his life is that he'd never suffered. He'd never been in a major disaster. He'd never had a major health problem, and his concern was, well, so what was the problem here? Well, partly it was theological, that disasters are the testing times. God sends us disasters in order to so that we can prove ourselves, and so that we can deepen ourselves, and so that we can act, and we can be responsible, return us to the path of purity, or whatever. And if that's the case, if culture puts so much emphasis on disaster as the testing ground, if you don't have disaster, then there's a sense in which life becomes thinned out in some ways, or weightless in some ways. And so this poor old archbishop was worrying about, I need a disaster. What's wrong with me? Why doesn't God like me anymore? And this was the language that was used through the 17th and 18th centuries, that the loving breath of God and so forth comes in the form of disasters. So that when we're thinking about contemporary cultural representations of disaster and their attractions, I think that it's also hidden within the kind of
Christian.
That's not Christian? They thought
Jesus is an example of a mediator within destruction.
Well, I mean, these were they were Congregationalists. I guess they count as Christians in sort of among, but there's lots of different types of Christianity, I suppose. But they were certainly viewing that sense of, and I suppose I'm thinking specifically about sort of American Protestantism, and Catholicism tends to play out in slightly different ways. But what I am trying to get at is the sense that our sort of embedded in our ways of thinking about disaster. Are these deep narratives that have been implanted there many years ago. So that even when we look at the language that we use, you know, acts of God and so forth, are inherited terms that for even people who don't believe in God necessarily will still call a disaster an act of God. And I think that not only that, but it's that sense of disasters that as a positive influence in people's lives is one of the things I wanted to add to this conversation. So that it's the thing that allows us to improve, deepen, test ourselves, and so forth.
Yeah. On a different plane, does the term destruction porn resonate at all? And whether or not voyeurism isn't one of the pleasures of the spectacle of destruction?
Yeah.
I guess we got a joke for the porn questions.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you that in the constitution of kind of the U.S. nuclear project, which was for the American public and the world a largely a visual project of distributing certain kind of images, it was also very much tied to censoring all other images. And right from 1945 going forward, there was a very explicit conversation about how you would locate citizens along a fear-terror circuit. Fear being constituted as a productive way of mobilizing a society at a time of kind of international risk and of maintaining the virtues of kind of wartime into a different kind of time, something that was eventually, you know, Cold War. But terror was seen as something that would be immobilizing, that would make the democratic society completely fall apart. And so image was key. The regulation and distribution of images was key to that. So there were certain images, say, of Hiroshima that focused on certain buildings, but nothing to do with the body destroyed by the bomb. Similarly, throughout the 20 years of above ground testing, you have these iconic images, like what's upstairs from Edgerton's work, of being very far away from a nuclear explosion, something that offers you an experience of the sublime, but also distance, protection, and a way of being very far away from it. There's a whole other visual project, which is about being very close to it, being very much inside, in terms of either dealing with structures or people or animals, right? And so this notion of calibrating emotions, calibrating perceptions through a very disciplined effort to deploy certain images and keep all other images out of circulation is one of the stories of the 20th century around destruction. And I think we're picking up on in the show lots of different ways in which artists are responding to not only the proliferation of the images of the bomb, but also the absences and the way, and are filling in some of the gaps around that project through various kinds of experimentation.
I want to ask something, actually a question to Carrie about the timing for the show. In right now, it's a I mean, I have my thoughts about it, but I just wanted to. Obviously, you don't have a mic, so I don't know if it's.
Yeah, I'd like to admit that we just put it together in a couple months after the shutdown. Right. Everyone but of course, it's been in production for a number of years, but we were. I was noted whether it be drone strikes or whatever, the kind of complicitness of our government and others in things that have happened around the world, beginning with the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. In terms of the timing, I think it's more about where the show's happening than
right.
The timing. I'm sure within a few more months, we'll see light again.
The reason I'm asking because obviously there are an immediate association with the apocalypse, and those associations are kind of coming, they're cyclical, and at the end of every of a century, end of millennium, we tend to have this. And I'm just thinking about 1914 and 2014.
Yeah.
The fact that
that's true. We were putting the show together.
I just came back from Vienna last week, and there was this great project there that started in the middle of the 19th century where the Kaiser wanted to rebuild Vienna and to create this grand new city that will resonate to ancient Greece, and everything was bubbling there. Demographically, it was clear looking from outside that the disaster is looming, but they were living, the ruling classes were living in a completely different, with a completely different sense of reality, and elevated art. So it's the first ever museum was built there, not a palace that was converted, but a real museum. And they finished building it. I just read about it. Vienna was complete dust, and for 40 or 50 years, they finished building it. And then obviously a few years later, in 1914, the whole thing fell apart and the world completely transformed. I have to say, walking in Washington through the mall and looking at all these Greek pillars and this kind of a grand exhibition of power and wealth, and walking into the National Gallery, and the time that we're in with this kind of notion there as well, there was an economic bubble. The money that the Kaiser managed to raise was not real money, and he kind of managed to materialize various properties and all sorts. And I just saw that, you know, the timing of damage control is as strong as.
Tell you, what's interesting is when we first talked about the show, we talked about it briefly as a show that would just focus on the late 40s, 50s, yep. 60s, maybe ending in the 70s or so.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just going to be that period, about more about the nuclear period and the fear of living under that, the destruction in art.
The destruction in art symposium period, actually, in the mid-60s. But as Russell and I talked about the exhibition, we kept saying, well, wait a second, you know, then this happened, and then this happened, and now this is happening. And there was something about feeling like we had if not come full circle, something on that order of fear, for example, of, you know, dirty bombs that was popping up at the time we first started talking about the show, you know, 9/11, a lot of terrorist strikes around the world, that we actually started to feel we can't stop the show. You know, there's a bit of a dip in the show, if you notice, and it's probably a weakness in the exhibition, actually, I will admit. Around the 1980s or so, early 90s, it fades out a little bit, with the exception of some Jack Goldstein paintings and a few other things. But then it comes back on in the 90s pretty strong, and then picks up again, you know, in the 2000s fairly radically. And so we ultimately made the decision that, just like the Hirshhorn's a circle, that we were coming full circle in the exhibition. One of the things I found really interesting, I hope it's okay, can we go ahead and talk now, Bob? Are you okay with... Okay. The you were talking about the digital. And there's some works near the end of the exhibition by Tomas Roof, which I find interesting in that sense, because they're nothing but JPEGs pulled off the internet and blown up to large proportions. And I'm not sure how to take those images. You know, from a distance, it's destruction. And it looks real, and they're very, you know, very much a kind of photojournalistic technique. As you walk closer to them, you start to see the pixelation in them, you see the tiling in it, and when you get right up to it, almost like pointillism, it starts to completely disappear into just the technique of digitalization. And, you know, so I find that discussion extremely interesting, and I do think, like in the Man of Steel movie, it's destruction for destruction's sake, whereas in the Antonioni movie, which is a real explosion, there's something more going on there. Okay. So.
I want to come back to another comment you made earlier and open it up, and that is, you talked about when you were younger, we all were, the notion of the atomic bomb and the duck and cover activities taking place in the school. One of the things that's easy to forget, that this was a qualitative shift. It used to be that people who thought the world was coming to an end carried signs, and you dismissed them as marginal and, you know, and kooks. Well, suddenly, and I like this phrase, it was used by Herman Kahn, the sort of right-wing thinker, thinking the unthinkable. He wrote a book on thermonuclear war in which he did the number. He played the numbers. If the bomb hit, how many people would be killed? How many people would survive? Would we win? Dr. Strangelove, perhaps, was in part based on Herman Kahn, but the phrase, thinking the unthinkable, is very important, it seems to me, in the history of the spectacle of destruction. You now had to bring into your mind the real possibility that the world was going to end. Not just crazy people in the schools. Well, the issue now, given all of the apocalyptic movies, images, and what have you, is that, are we again at a qualitative shift? At a point where we are thinking the unthinkable. It has now become credible again that the waves will roll into New York, that global warming, that any number of things have entered into people's consciousness, where it's now a kind of taken for granted among young people that there's a chance, maybe a good chance, the world will come to an end. And what impact that has had on imaging and storytelling. Are we at that turning point again? Or is that just a passing...
I think some of the imagery seems to be changing. I'm very curious about this zombie apocalypse idea as well. And it suggests that there's some kind of concern about, you know, global pandemics, biological disasters rather than natural or technological disasters, and it's sort of raising new questions of representation as well. And how do you, you know that you're in the presence of a disaster movie when something spectacular happens. How do you represent a pandemic? Well, zombies is a good way of doing it, I guess. Yeah. And then you sort of. But it suggests that this is wrestling with a new type of threat, but still trying to figure out a way to introduce it into the culture.
I should pass the mic around, but is Kenneth here from the Bulletin?
Yes.
Hi. I wondered maybe you might take the mic for a second and ask because you got one. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists invented the doomsday clock, and the representative is sitting right there. And the doomsday clock, I think, had been as far back as maybe what, 12 to midnight or something at one time?
As far back as 17 minutes.
17
to
minutes.
Yeah.
Now it's at 5.
Right.
5 to midnight. So I think there's something in what you're saying.
Right.
In fact, the clock was created by an artist, a young artist, Martil Langsdorff, who died just last May. She was married to a physicist who'd worked in the Manhattan Project, and as she was being asked to design the first cover of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, she played around with some ideas and was part of the scientist movement at the University of Chicago, where people were debating very heatedly and passionately about what they had done, what they had created. The bomb which could destroy the world, there was talk at the time that it might even ignite the atmosphere and the first test, Trinity, and could really destroy the world. So she was struck by the urgency. So the clock, rather than a uranium symbol or an atomic symbol, the clock seemed to her to capture the spirit of that time and the sense of urgency that the scientists had that everyone should know as much as possible about this horrible, devastating technology. And it really did become, and has been since then, the single most dangerous technology on the Earth. We can destroy ourselves. And really, I think Jonathan Schell and others, Joe, have talked about this as a singular moment in human history, where it's not locusts or floods, the Noah's flood, or fire. It's our own fire. It's the fire that we've created. And so the technology, which is a kind of art in a way, it's a construction out of our own consciousness, out of our intelligence and brain, is coming back to kill us. And so the doomsday clock, although it was kind of called the clock of doom, not by the scientists, but by media people who wanted to give it a cute name, we've taken it on, the doomsday clock, and tried to, over these 65 years, to tell people how close we think, the scientists think we are, to doing ourselves in. So it's still at 5 minutes to midnight. It was at 2 minutes to midnight in 1954 when the U.S. and the Soviet Union detonated the first hydrogen bombs within 6 months of each other, a very difficult period in our history. We seem to feel like we're a little bit more complacent now, but the threat of climate change has been added to the clock. And with that, we think, just as you've been saying today, that is certainly another way in which, through our own technological genius, in this slapstick metaphor, which I loved this morning, we will, hit ourselves in the head, literally, and do ourselves in.
In terms of spectacle, 1954, when it was 2 minutes to midnight, is also the year that Godzilla was made in Tokyo. And they're making a new version, which is coming out this year, in 2014, in May, I think it is, based on the original.
I think that Paul Virilio made an analogy between the bomb and God, and he kind of attributed, if we human being created God, we created something that we're living under the fear of, we made something not to be used, and this monstrous force is hovering above our head and really dictate or a shadow that is having an effect on our day-to-day activity.
Other question, way in the back there. Just wait for the microphone.
Thank you for the discussion. It's very interesting. And I just wanted to point out that chronologies can be tricky anyhow. And obviously, you know, this has to be modern and contemporary, so it has to be delimited in some fashion. But the early modern art historian in me, while pacing the exhibition, kept thinking, you know, there's nothing new about this, essentially, you know, to evoke something, a point that was made earlier on. You could talk about, I mean, the very notion of iconoclasm refers to a specific period in Byzantine art, right? You can talk about palimpsests in manuscripts that were written over and erased and written over. You can talk about executions that were very public, sort of part of everyday life as a performance piece, at least for the people that and the state that organized it, with impunity, as was talked about earlier on. So it seems to me that, you know, we have to talk about it in a certain context, right? That incorporates a whole visual tradition and a whole sort of ethical and political background that is not new, that has nothing to do necessarily with the atomic age, right? And is not specific to it. So I don't know if you would care to speak about that, and also about more broadly art and artists that evoke that sort of historical past in their work about destruction. Thank you.
Anyone else out there? Questions, comments? Yeah, right back there.
Thank you also for this very interesting thought that you brought, and also while listening to, there were many topics, very interesting topics that were put up, and I was thinking then again now to the movie, and thank you for showing us this beautiful thing, and I at some point just started to see this movie, Antonioni, showing us that destruction could be a part of a revelation of what is the real value of what is destructed, what we have before our eyes. Because you see first the house blowing up from different views, going only closer and closer, and then it starts to be really like a dream. The house is, of course, something I think very valuable. It's a home, it's where you live, where you have all your whatever families and souvenirs and so on and so on. And then you start, we started to see the some personal elements blowing through the sky, the closest, then very futility things destroying, like the you see the closest thing, and then also the cornflakes and the chicken that was going through the air, and then a little bit later you see the books, you see the so, and it was like revelating what is the value of what is in front of us and what is being destroyed. So just as a thought or comment, is destruction not it's when it's you talked about authenticity, when it's destruction we look for authenticity in what it, because when it's destructed it is something real that it's happening, but it also reveals the value of it, because when it's destructed, first you see the inside a little bit, in like the piano yesterday that we saw, you saw more of, but not also not only the inside of the aesthetical part, I mean the aesthetic inside, but the hardness, the quality, you saw the things, the parts that made the music, other parts that were just making noise, you see, and the different materials. So it's really a revelation of what it's inside and the value of it, and also the loss of it, because when it's destructed, it's also lost forever. And so this combination of revelation of value and losing of this value seems also to me a very important topic in this discussion.
That's great. Who please.
I guess as I was talking about the scientists' realization that we really could destroy ourselves, I mean, we could destroy now with climate change not only the humans, but also all of the habitat and the entire planet. And I wonder whether this isn't a really huge challenge to art, because in fact the loss is so complete that there's no consciousness left. If it were to pass, if humans became extinct, which is possible with climate change or with some other things that we've talked about technologically, it is a possibility. So is it possible for artists to really represent that kind of entire loss of consciousness of a species, and maybe several species? And perhaps your question about this all seems familiar, right? I mean, so 1950 on, so big deal. Maybe it's just beyond our grasp, really, to understand what it would mean for the annihilation of the entire human race. And maybe that's why it's so difficult for art and artists to really grapple on some level, despite the films and all sorts of things, but to actually grasp what that would mean. That's a question.
That seems like a perfect. We have one more. Okay. That seems like a perfect note to end on. Once again, I can't grasp it myself. So, but I want to thank so much our panelists. I feel like we could go on for another 2 hours, actually, myself. But I want to say thank you to each and every one of you for being here today on the panel. It was absolutely fascinating. And thanks to all of you for being here all day with us. If you missed the morning panel, or if you had to come in late for this one, we will have all of the videos for the symposium on our website soon. And also, if we were talking about the Piano Destruction concert, if you were not here last night and didn't get to see it, the remnants of the destruction are in the first gallery on the second floor, but we will also be posting the video of the performance on our website soon, so keep checking. Thank you very much for coming, and we hope to see you soon.